Welcome to CFRI Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Everyone knows who you are.
Hello, everyone. I'm Siri Vaith, Executive Director of CFRI, and it is my honor and privilege to welcome you to what promises to be a very fascinating podcast today with Dr. Bridget Gompertz of the Broad Stem Cell Research Center at UCLA. As always, before we get started, I do want to remind people the information presented in this recording should not be used for any medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and before making any changes to your treatment plan, please consult with your medical team. In addition, before we get started, I do want to thank our sponsors of this podcast series, Vertex Pharmaceuticals, Gilead Sciences, Genentech, Chiesi USA, and Mylan. Dr. Bridget Gompertz is a professor and vice chair of research in pediatric hematology, oncology, and pulmonary medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, where she leads a lab at the Eli and Edith Broad Center of Regenerative Medicine and Stem Cell Research. Her scientific research focuses on the role stem cells play in repairing and regenerating the lungs after injury. As you'll hear, Dr. Gompertz's lab was the first to use stem cells to create lung-like organoids that mimic the air sac structures of actual lungs that, among other things, are used for high-throughput drug screening and which someday might lead to the generation of patient-specific transplantable lung tissue. We are so honored to have Dr. Gompertz join us to share her work. Welcome.
So I'm a physician scientist at UCLA, and that means that in addition to running a research lab, I also take care of patients. I'm a pediatric hematologist-oncologist and take care of kids with cancer and blood diseases. And several years ago, I was taking care of a patient who had a bone marrow transplant for a bad bone marrow disorder. And she initially did really well with the bone marrow transplant, but then the bone marrow transplant started attacking her lungs. And ultimately, this caused really bad scarring and took over a large amount of her lungs. And so eventually, she succumbed to her disease. And this really affected me a lot. I was very close to the patient and her family. And I realized that we really have very few therapies for lung diseases, very little that directly targets the underlying disease. And so since then, I've really been working hard in my lab to create models of lung diseases and that I'm hoping will ultimately be able to help us to get to therapies.
So we're going to start with, we're going to hold this podcast as a question and answer structure. And so these are questions that have been submitted by our community. So welcome, Dr. Gompertz, and we're so glad you're here. And the first question is going to be the most broad of all. What is stem cell research?
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity to speak with you all today. It's a real privilege to be able to tell you a bit about the work that we've been doing in my lab here at UCLA. And I want to start off by giving you just a brief overview about stem cells and what they are. Well, stem cell research is research on these very unique cells called stem cells, and they are able to help us understand a lot of biology. They help us understand more about development, about aging, and about a whole bunch of diverse things that cells do. And we can use them as experimental model systems to study diseases. And in this way, we can use them to develop cell-based therapies and even to improve pharmaceutical development to test, for example, whether drugs might be toxic to cells and also how the best way is to deliver a specific drug to a specific cell. In the cell, you can see an embryonic stem cell in culture. And here there is fluorescent staining highlighting different markers that explain that it's a pluripotent cell with a lot of potential to make different cell types. So stem cell research really involves regenerative medicine. And this is the art of medicine where we're trying to engineer organs to study different diseases, as well as to possibly think about in the future whether we could actually bioengineer or make new organs. And really, there are two major aspects of regenerative medicine. The first is stem cells. And as we talked about, stem cells are these really novel different kinds of cells. And there are multiple different kinds of stem cells. There are adult stem cells that are present in all of our tissues. And they're there to help renew our organs. So every day we lose billions of cells, and our organs all have the capacity to make new cells to keep our organs functioning. And then there's another kind of stem cell called the pluripotent stem cells. And these include the embryonic stem cells and the induced pluripotent stem cells. And these stem cells are stem cells that have the incredible capacity to make any cell type of the body. Whereas the adult stem cells can really only make the cells that are present within a particular tissue or organ. And so really the definition of a stem cell is that it's a single cell that can replicate or essentially make more of itself, or it can go on and differentiate into a specific cell type that has a unique function. So for example, in the lungs, it might be a very important cell for gas exchange, whereas in the liver, it might be a very important cell for detoxifying different kinds of drugs. And so those are highly specialized cells. And again, as we pointed out, the pluripotent stem cells can make any cell type in the body, but the adult stem cells can only make just those functional cells of an individual tissue or organ. So when we think about stem cells, we start out with the totipotent stem cells. And these are really the stem cells that are present in embryos. And of course, once an egg is fertilized, those cells, those stem cells have the capacity to make any cell type within the body. But we also now have the ability to take cells, and this is any cell type from the body, and recreate these embryonic stem cells, so make cells that are very similar to embryonic stem cells, as shown over here. And these can be then cultured and, as we say, differentiated into all the functional cell types of the body. And we're getting better and better at working with induced pluripotent stem cells to make different cell types. And then over here are the tissue-specific stem cells. And these are the stem cells that we're trying to get the induced pluripotent stem cells to make. So for example, for blood, those would be the hematopoietic stem cells, making the blood cells. For the nervous system, it's the neural stem cells that can make the neurons. And then for things like connective tissue or bones or cartilage, it's the mesenchymal stem cells that we're working with. And ultimately, these then become multipotent and can make these different cell types of the body. So this would be a classic example of what embryonic stem cells and now induced pluripotent stem cells are capable of doing. So as I mentioned in the previous slide, which really talked about embryonic stem cells and the incredible potential of those stem cells, this is describing how induced pluripotent stem cells can be derived from just regular, we call them somatic cells or mature cells from the body. And they can now be differentiated into a number of different cell types. And you'll notice that lung cell types are actually not present on here, but now we do have the ability to make different lung cell types, particularly type 1 and type 2 pneumocytes, which is very exciting. And of course, all of this was made possible by the Nobel Prize winning work of Shinya Yamanaka in 2012. And he discovered how to take these adult mature cells and essentially turn the clock back on them to make them into induced pluripotent stem cells. Well, one of the central questions in biology is how do cells know what to become? So we know that we have the same genetic material in all of our cells, but how does an eye cell, for example, differ from a nose cell? And really, this is a fascinating question, and there's still a lot of research that's being done in this area. But what we do know is that a cell doesn't exist in isolation, and that there are a number of different factors around the cell that we call niche factors that will help dictate which genes are expressed, which proteins are made. And if we can figure out how to use these niche factors to really control the different cells and get them to go into different kinds of cells or different specialized cells, then these cells could potentially be used for tissue therapy. And of course, potentially we could use genetic engineering to change the gene expression in the way that we want it to make specific cell types. So this is a really exciting area of biology. So I mentioned earlier about niche factors, and really niche factors are signals to stem cells that help dictate their biology or the way that they behave. So these include things like the extracellular matrix that surrounds the cells, a whole lot of soluble factors that cells are secreting and giving off as little signals. And then the other cells that are around the stem cells are also giving cues to the stem cells. And all of these combined will dictate how the stem cell behaves. So it'll decide whether the stem cell self-renews and makes more of itself, or whether it goes on and differentiates and makes the functional cell types of that particular tissue or organ. So why do researchers want to use embryonic stem cells or induced pluripotent stem cells? Well, it turns out that pluripotent cells really give us a beautiful window into how development works and also allows us to better understand how tissue-specific adult stem cells work. And this is very important because, of course, this has a window in on regenerative biology for specific organs or tissues, and also allows us to move towards thinking about therapeutics. And this is because these stem cells can proliferate indefinitely in culture. So we don't worry about them dying and us losing our cells, but we can keep on working with them. And of course, adult stem cells are really difficult to get hold of. We have to get tissue, and it's difficult to get tissue from patients. So having the pluripotent stem cells in the dish allows us to make any tissue that we want to, which accelerates research. I've been fascinated with this area of tissue bioengineering and the idea of combining cell biology with bioengineering materials and techniques. And this is because we know that there are specific features of tissue that we can use bioengineering to help us model. So for example, the idea of mechanobiology, which is just that there are different stresses and strains and forces in a particular tissue that can dictate how a stem cell would behave. We also know that there are specific materials that can be mimicked to be able to grow cells in a dish that will be more closely approximate to what's actually found within an organ. And we call this tissue scaffolding. And then we also know that bioengineering techniques can better help us model tissues and also help us get towards models that are amenable to things like high throughput drug screening. And this involves really amazing high-tech imaging techniques with amazing microscopes where we can pick up teeny tiny details. And so for all of these reasons, bioengineering is really important as we think about building tissues and using tissues to study diseases.
So then if at this time you could go into greater detail about your lab's revolutionary work to create the scaffolding and the lung organoids.
So it turns out that bioengineering the lungs is actually quite a big challenge. There are actually more than 42 different cell types in the lung, and we seem like we keep finding different types of cells every couple of months. And as I mentioned earlier, the mechanobiology, which is the stretch and the elasticity of the lungs, is very important, as you can see in these lungs that are, you know, it's just a diagrammatic representation of breathing. But we all know, as we're sitting here breathing, our lungs are stretching and relaxing without us even thinking about it. But that's giving very important cues to the cells. And of course, there's blood vessels. And that's what I mean by the vascularization. And that blood vessels play a very important role in helping with the oxygenation and really the gas exchange within the lungs. And so when my lab set out to work on this, I had a very talented bioengineering graduate student in the lab, in Bruce Dunn's lab. His name's Dan Wilkinson. And he started by looking at these photomicrographs at very, very high resolution to look at the lung ultrastructure. And that's what's shown over here, is these interconnecting alveolar sacs and how beautiful they are, but how fragile and tiny they are. And this is really what he had to replicate, is this very large surface area when trying to bioengineer lungs. And he came up with this really ingenious strategy to try and build the same structure. And so the way I think about this is that if you're at the grocery store, if you could even be at a grocery store now, but if you could be in the grocery store, and if you saw a pile of oranges, so here are the oranges, these are these round spheres. And if you think about the space between the oranges, that's the green part here. And then if we move here, and if you think about if you remove the oranges, but just had the green space, and if the cells filled in these green spaces, then essentially you would have these interconnecting spheres or air-filled sacs, which would closely resemble what we see in the lung. And we call this the inverse opal structure. And this is a photomicrograph of an inverse opal structure, seeing how closely it replicates the alveolar structures that are so intricately related to each other. And what's wonderful is that these inverse opals, in theory, each one is directly connected to its surrounding structures, which is very similar to the alveolar sacs. And so what Dan did is to think of a method of how he could generate the lung structures, recapitulating this inverse opal biology. So he started out with some beads, and he just used hydrogel beads that are inert, and so they don't react in the body, so they could be put into the body. And there are already other applications where these hydrogels are put into the body without any problems. And then he functionalizes, which means that he just coats them with some extracellular matrix. Here it's collagen, and this just makes them sticky. And then he puts them in a bioreactor, which spins, and he spins the cells and the sticky beads together. And what happens is the cells coat the beads, as you can see here. And then when that happens, he then spins the cell-coated beads down together, and the cells around the beads start to form these junctions between the beads and ultimately pull together. And so what this ends up looking like is, here are the beads. We're using alginate as the hydrogel. Here is the collagen, which is the sticky stuff around the beads. And here in green are the cells that are coating the beads. And then this is the bioreactor. I don't know if you can see it going around and around, but essentially this is the beads and the cells that are interacting with each other so that the cells can stick onto the beads. And then ultimately we're able to pull those cell-coated beads together to form little structures that can be as big as a centimeter or even bigger, depending on the size of the bioreactor, or teeny tiny, like in this little 96 well dish, which could then be used for high throughput screening. And so this is a cross section of these little organoids. And on the right is normal human lung. And you can see these interconnecting alveolar sacs in black with the cells that are these multicolored cells around the alveolar sacs. And you can see that it's pretty closely represented in our bioengineered lung structures. So we're able to get the cells in the right location and recreate the microarchitecture of the lungs. But unfortunately, we're not able to recapitulate the actual blood vessels. So we still haven't solved the problem of the microvasculature or the blood vessels, the little capillaries that are all hooked together to eventually form blood vessels. And that's something that we're actively working on and proves to be very, very challenging for all organs. So here are some blown up versions of some of the images that you saw in the previous slide. And here is this little piece of bioengineered lung tissue with the alveolar sacs coated with the alveolar cells. And this is about a centimeter by a centimeter. So it's not particularly large, but it could be scaled up to something more relevant to patients. And here is the cross section through the normal lung tissue, where you can see the alveolar sacs in black that are lined by cells, which are these multicolored structures. And you can see that it pretty closely resembles what you see in the bioengineered lung tissue, where you see the alveolar sacs in black, which are lined by these cells. And these, of course, are the same lung cell types as we see in the regular lung. The only issue is that the capillaries that we get are not able to form blood vessels and interconnect with each other. And so we haven't recreated really the true vascularization of the lungs. And this is something that we're actively working on. And it turns out that this is very tricky for all organs right now. So essentially what we've done is to take these organoids, which we can scale up to very big or very small, and now we're making them teeny tiny. And in our molecular shared screening resource at UCLA, we have these robotic arms that can do this incredible micropipetting into this is a 384 well plate. So each well is teeny tiny. And then in red, each of these little red circles represents a little organoid, a little lung organoid. And our goal is to make them as reproducible as possible. And here I'm showing you how we can make 384 of these in one little plate. And then I've blown up one of the little organoids to show you the cells in green. And blue is the nucleus of the cells, just to show you what these little organoids look like and how closely they resemble the alveolar sacs of the lung, but in teeny tiny. And this is another example of these little lung organoids. And here we're just using pretty colors, using immunofluorescent staining to look for specific markers that tell us which specific cell types of the lung we have. And here in pink, we're showing you some cells that are active. And then over here in the middle, the green cells are the cells that represent the type 1 and type 2 alveolar cells. And the red cells are the fibroblasts. And then over here on the right, I'm showing you how the cells, some of the active cells have the red dye in them, so that we have this really live, living little lung organoid that has markers of the lung tissue and is active just like lung tissue. But how does this apply to cystic fibrosis? Well, the lungs are very complex and they are structurally and functionally quite different in terms of different regions of the lung. So when we think about the lungs, we actually think about the upper airways, which includes the nose and mouth. And then we have the proximal cartilaginous airways, which includes the trachea or windpipe and the bronchi. And these are directly in contact with the environment, and they play this very important role in defending the body against viruses and bacteria and any pollution or toxins that we may breathe in. And so they have a very different structure, and the cells are differentiated in a very different way to be able to form that important function. And then if we move down distally through the bronchioles, we end up at the alveolar sacs, which we've talked a lot about today. And this is where the gas exchange occurs, where oxygen is able to enter the body and carbon dioxide is able to be expelled. And so CF, of course, is a disease of the mucus because the mucus is dehydrated and not able to be cleared from the airways. And that ultimately sets up these ongoing infections, which ultimately lead to damage throughout the lungs, including in the alveolar sacs. But really, what I wanted to also share is some work that we've been doing in my lab on these upper, more proximal airways and in terms of thinking about mucus clearance. And so mucociliary clearance is really vital to protect the host. And what it does is it takes advantage of some highly specialized cells in the trachea and the bronchi. And so these cells sit on the basement membrane. And they consist of these goblet cells or mucus cells that make the mucus. And then there are these ciliated cells that have these little hair-like projections that beat unilaterally, as shown over here. And then there are these stem cells, and these are called basal or airway basal stem cells. And these are the tissue-specific adult stem cells that are capable of self-renewing, but also giving rise to the differentiated mucus cells and ciliated cells of the proximal airway. And the function of the CFTR is to make enough water to create this pericillary layer so that the little ciliated hair cells can beat easily, because they wouldn't be able to beat through the sticky mucus. And you can see in this way, the cilia are beating through this watery pericillary liquid. And that way we clear all of the bad things that we breathe in. Obviously in cystic fibrosis, this pericillary liquid layer is very low or absent. The mucus sits directly on the ciliated cells so that they can't beat and they can't clear the mucus. And it's the mucus that's sitting in the airways that gets infected and drives the whole problem. So one beautiful thing that we can actually do in the lab is that we can actually reproduce the mucociliary epithelium. And this is a technique that was actually developed a few decades ago now. And this is, again, showing you what the human airway looks like. This is this mucociliary epithelium. Here are the little cilia on the top. And there are mucus cells in between as well, and the basal cells, the stem cells are sitting on the bottom. And this is just a cartoon representing the same thing. And I do now have mentioned club cells, which are a kind of secretory cell that contributes to more of these host defense proteins that are made up in the mucus. But what we're able to do is to actually take these stem cells. So we get this tissue in the lab, and we're able to remove all of this top part of the tissue because this won't survive in the dish, but the stem cells will. So we take the stem cells out and we put them into what we call a transwell system. And this is just really a little culture dish, which has got a little insert in it with this 0.4 micron pore membrane. And so the cells can sit on top, and the media, which is the growth liquid, which has got all the growth factors that are needed, can move in and out through the pores, but the cells are too big to move through the pores. And what happens is that these primary human bronchial epithelial cells, or HBECs, will grow on the pore, on the membrane. And what they'll do is that they'll form this very nice layer, and it's a very tight layer. So that what can happen is when that tight layer is formed, we can actually take away the liquid media with the growth factors from the top surface and just have the liquid media in the bottom surface. And the cells are so tightly adherent, they don't allow the media through. And in this way, we create something called an air-liquid interface. And what happens is, if you think about our trachea, for example, the top part of the cells is an air, and the bottom part is getting fed by the blood vessels, kind of like our media. And so we've essentially created a top and a bottom for the cells. And in this way, the stem cells know to go on and differentiate. And so we can get the ciliated cells, and we can get the mucous cells, and we can completely recapitulate this mucociliary epithelium. And this is what it looks like when we look at the different cell types in my lab. And I should first of all mention that the work is being done by some very talented scientists who, despite COVID and all of the challenges, are working in my lab right now, Erinna Mukwekeliasta, Chandani Sen, and Abdo Dara. And so what they do is they do these cultures, and then they use these special immunofluorescent stains to look at the different cell types. Here in a set for acetylated tubulin in green, this is what the cilia look like, those little hair-like projections that beat unilaterally. The mucous cells here stained with MUC5AC are the reddish cells, and you can see that there is definitely mucus production in the cultures too. And then in keratin 5 in white, these are the basal stem cells. And so we can detect all of the different cell types and see different, if we change different exposures or do different things to the cells, how these cells change within the culture. So it's a very nice system to study the proximal airway and the mucociliary epithelium. So we're thinking a lot about induced pluripotent stem cells and how they could potentially be used to treat cystic fibrosis, because we know that cystic fibrosis is a monogenic disease, meaning that it might be amenable to gene therapy. And so really the way we envision this happening would be that a patient could donate blood cells, which could then be genetically reprogrammed into human-induced pluripotent stem cells. And these would then undergo differentiation to the mucociliary epithelium, as well as genetic modification of the specific genetic mutation that an individual patient may have. And that these cells could then be expanded and then potentially transplanted into the patient. And there are also some groups who believe that this genetic modification could actually happen within the airway cells within a patient. And so this is one potential area that a lot of research is going into. But of course, there's also been a lot of work with high throughput drug screening with a number of different models, including the air liquid interface model. And this has been very successfully used to identify CFTR potentiators and potentially other therapies, and could potentially also be used to study gene therapies. And of course, we also would love to think about bioengineering of individual lungs for specific patients. But I think that this is much further away in terms of ultimately, one day getting to the clinic. But that's something that we would really love to be able to do. Of course, now we're in the fall of 2020 and in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so we and many other labs around the world, we're repurposing our lung models to study COVID-19. And here I'd like to share with you some of our data on the air liquid interface model, which has been infected with the live SARS-CoV-2 virus here at UCLA with our amazing virologist colleague, Vaiti Rumagaswamy, who takes our little air liquid interface model and puts them in these high containment facilities under BSL-3 conditions. And you can see that even with a low dose of the virus, which is what he uses, we can see the green cells. These green cells are all cells that are infected with the virus. And the red cells are the cells that are starting to die and obviously are affected by the virus. And so we've been using this to study different compounds, really thinking towards therapeutics. And I wanted to show you some examples of some of the studies that we've done. One of them is treating with remdesivir, which of course is being now used a lot throughout the country as a potential therapy for COVID-19, although I know there's been some controversy with different studies. And here we do see that remdesivir has a pretty good effect at preventing viral infection, but there are still patches of virally infected cells. But another compound that we've been working with, which is also in clinical trials, is interferon beta. And this came out of a screen that we did with the adequate interface cultures. And we found really impressive prevention of infection with interferon beta, although some of this, there's still some cell death, and obviously the cells are still impacted by the virus, but we see much less viral infection. And so we're continuing to screen more and more compounds, ultimately hoping that we'll find a therapy that could be quickly repurposed to the clinic for patients. Well, it's really been wonderful having this opportunity to share some of our work with you. And we really hope, you know, to make great strides in the future. We know that there's a large unmet clinical need, and we're working really hard to find new therapies and new ways of treating cystic fibrosis. And obviously now this terrible pandemic too.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gompertz, for being here and sharing this incredible research. It's just, it is mind-boggling how much progress has been made, and really exciting to think of where we could be going if we are able to stay the course. So thank you so much for sharing your time and your expertise. And if I can impose on you a little longer, we do have questions from people. And but before we get started, I actually personally have a question for you, which is, CFRI years ago was an endorsing organization of Prop 71. And for those of you who don't know, in California, Proposition 71 led to the formation of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. And my understanding is that your inspired research is partially supported through funds from CIRM, the institute. Is this true?
Yes. So when I was just starting out my lab, I was a new faculty, and I was able to get a CIRM Career Development Award. And that was just an incredible boost for me because it not only gave me funds to be able to do the work and to start to answer the questions that we really thought needed to be addressed, but it also put me in contact with so many amazing scientific, you know, stem cell researchers, and was able to bring in these amazing stem cell researchers from all over the world, which was amazing for me to interact with. And I could honestly say that without the CIRM funding, I don't think that I would have a lab today. I don't think we would be doing the work that we're doing right now, because especially when you're starting out as a young investigator, it's really hard to find funding, especially for new ideas. And CIRM was just fantastic at helping us. And now, you know, CIRM again are on the cutting edge. They're helping fund our drug screening testing for COVID-19. So again, they're helping us move new work forward. We're hoping, you know, to really break barriers.
And for those people who are in California, who are part of the CFRI community, you know well that we have endorsed Proposition 14, which we hope California voters will pass. That will actually continue funding for the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, and hopefully continue this type of work and the work of others, Matt Porteous up at Stanford, who's been working in the area of CF. And so I guess that's my other question. How much do you all, it's such a specialized field, how much interaction is there between stem cell researchers nationwide, statewide, nationwide, globally?
So actually, there's a lot of interaction between stem cell researchers because we're not a really huge group. And I would say it tends to be more tissue specific, but it's actually interesting how it kind of goes across tissues. And maybe that's because we're sort of all kind of undifferentiated, like induced red blood stem cells. But so, for example, within our Broad Stem Cell Research Center at UCLA, I interact with all of the stem cell members, and we have a lot of cross collaborations, which is super helpful. So that's the way I was able to interact with bioengineers to start to think about, you know, these actual true lung tissue modeling. And it's also just amazing to work with these amazing stem cell researchers, for example, bioinformatics expertise to help us with things like single cell RNA sequencing, or just, there's just so many areas that the Stem Cell Center helps us with. And then of course, within California, we've had a number of stem cell meetings, which have brought us all together. a lot of it through the three Broad Stem Cell Research Centers that you have at UCLA, USC, and then up at UCSF. And those have been, you know, really wonderful ways of getting together with people. And then we also have some really great stem cell societies that will bring in national and international groups. And so I feel like I have collaborated with people all over the world, still continue to collaborate with people all over the world, and have had a number of students come from all over the world to the lab with stem cell background from their countries. And I feel like it's been this great exchange. And yes, so a lot of that has been you know, due to individuals funding stem cell research, but a large part of it in California is thanks to CIRM, and CIRM really being able to pull in so many fantastic investigators in the stem cell area from all over the world and be able to really push us to try and translate our work.
And with this, you're focused on lung organoids, but is there, so it is across disease groups of stem cell researchers that are sharing their information. Did I understand you correctly?
So for example, there's been amazing progress in the areas of regenerating things like livers and kidneys, and all of those groups, the work that they've done has been helpful in informing what we're doing and, you know, thinking about doing with the lung. Particularly with the induced pluripotent stem cell differentiation, it seems like many of the different groups from the different organs are actually informing each other's work. So there are obviously similarities and differences, but the overall approaches can sometimes be very helpful.
Somebody had asked that they had read about at the Mayo Clinic, they had read about Mayo researchers working to generate a functioning lung that is suitable for transplantation. This sounds like almost like science fiction, but do you see, obviously this is a ways out, but do you see the potential for it to actually come to that level where there would be transplantable actual replacement tissue?
Yeah, so there are actually several groups, even around the world, who are working on different ways to think about how lung tissue could be created. Obviously, it would be individualized to each patient, and so there would be no chance of rejection. And I think that this is still a way away. There are a lot of challenges, like I mentioned before, with creating blood supply that would then have to be hooked up to a patient's blood supply, in addition to hooking the airways up to the little lung airways. So there are many, many challenges. But I do believe that in the future, we will be able to make lung organs, and that ultimately they could be used for transplantation. But of course, I couldn't tell you how many decades away that is, but I think it's still far away.
So in the end, we really have to believe in the potential of this, because it seems like the building blocks are being laid to move us towards a larger goal. But in the meantime, especially during the pandemic, it seems like such incredible work is being done that is relevant right now and useful right now. Well, Dr. Gompertz, it has been an honor and a privilege to have this webinar podcast with you. I'm so grateful to you for sharing your time and your expertise with CFRI and our CF community. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you to CFRI for inviting me. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much.